And so he, euthanasia is off the table. He doesn't want to put him in a home because, you know, he wants to be able to see his son every day. And so day after day, he tends and tries to care for his son, but you know, each time he sees him, it describes as re-experiences the trauma. His son is, for the most part, he's gone. His body remains. And as he, you know, people pour in their you know, empathy and sympathy and, you know, trying to give some level of security that, hey, we care about you and we understand it's a hard time. He describes his own experience, you know, as they say, well, I can't imagine how hard it must be. And he writes, it turns out unfathomable tragic loss isn't very hard. It's easy, in fact. Easy in the same way that falling off a cliff is easy. Gravity does all the work for you. It's not like climbing Mount Everest, desperately trying to put one foot in front of the other. It's not like struggling to answer the questions on final exam. Tragic loss is just something that happens to you. And this man is dealing with this tragic loss of, you know, this son who, well, with no real expectation to ever awaken from this brain-dead state, just to be nourished and fed for the rest of his life, whether it's years or decades or whoever, how long. And what keeps him going? What sustains somebody who is crushed in that way? What keeps them from just wallowing in sorrow? And what gives them life when, well, in the midst of despair? Now, if you would turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 37, it's on page 40 if you're using one of your pew Bibles. And we began going through the story of Joseph. And, you know, Joseph, well, we begin the story with some really good news for him, but also some bad news. The bad news is that he comes from a horrible family. I mean, at least dysfunctional, right? They're, you know, they're 12 sons from 4 different women, all kind of, you know, vying for some level of power and prestige, and he, well, he is both the favored son of the father, but also the hated brother amongst his people. But the story of Joseph is one of hope. Hope in the midst of despair. As we began talking about last week, you know, when we say hope, we're not talking about the wistful thinking of, I hope things get better. I hope things are a little bit better than what they are, or maybe my future may be like this. We're talking about a distinctly Christian hope. Not just maybe things will be, but a hope that is bound and tied to both the character and the promises of God. And for the people of God, throughout all the ages, this kind of hope is core to who they are. It's the sustaining virtue in times of trial and tribulation. So we're in Genesis chapter 37. We're going to start reading at verse 12. So now, Joseph's brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I'm going to send you to them. Very well, he replied. So he said to him, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks and bring back word to me. Then he sent them off to the valley of Hebron. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields, and he asked him, what are you looking for? And he replied, well, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they're grazing their flocks? Well, they've moved on from here, the man said. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But when they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him. Throw him into one of these cisterns and say that the ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. When Reuben, he's the oldest, heard this, He tried to rescue him from their hands. "Let's not take his life," he said. "Don't shed any blood. Throw him into the cistern here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him." Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take them back to his father. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and they threw him into a cistern. The cistern was empty. There was no water in it. And as they sat down to eat their meal, they looked up and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh. They were on their way to take him down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come on, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. I mean, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood, after all." So his brothers agreed. And when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph wasn't there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Now where can I turn now?" Then they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, dipped the robe in blood. They took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it's your son's robe." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned his son for many days. All his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. "No," he said, "I will continue to mourn until I join my son in the grave." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold Joseph to Egypt, in Egypt, to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials and the captain of his guard. One of the most striking things about this story is seeing the unspoken hand of God at work and realizing, that his ways are not our ways, his thoughts are not our thoughts, his plans are not our plans. And while we plan and strive to do and accomplish our will, to mold our world to our liking, the plan of God marches forward anyway. It continues to move. Now, my daughters, I have four daughters. The oldest is 9, the youngest is 3. And one of their favorite things to do with me is to wrestle. And so sometimes they'll ask me, "Hey, Dad, can we wrestle tonight?" And if I say, "Yes, we can," they end up doing something. They gather together, and they try to plan and plot how they're going to overtake Dad, right? I don't want to be too unfair and listening on their plans, but it's like I'm going to zoom over here, then you're going to dance over here, and I'm going to flank him on the backside, and I do what you do. I hear them planning and plotting, and I laugh. I mean, for a couple reasons. One, their plans are terrible. I mean, it's like, when you watch like those family movies where, there's a bad guy adult and the kids do these things and distract them and the guy just stands there befuddled because things are moving around him. They think that that's me. Like, if I dance over here, he's not going to see you, but the other, the more laughable part is that, even if their plan worked, even if they executed it perfectly, when I am double the combined weight of all of them, and quadruple the combined strength of all of them, their plans aren't really much good. They can, I can let them carry it out and jump on my back, but they can't take me down, right? It's kind of like, in Psalm 2, when the psalmist asks, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? That the kings of the earth rise up and the rulers band together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, "Let's break their chains and throw off their shackles." But what does heaven do? It says, "The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at him." And here in the text of Joseph, we see this very same principle as the Lord of heaven laughs at the plans, the machinations of evil, wicked men to deal with life as it is, and their failure, which ultimately, for the people of God, should bring us great comfort and hope, that even while it seems that the opponents are getting their way, that the will and the plan of God is being thwarted, God's plan continues. And that brings us great, great hope. Now imagine for a moment, to see things for a second through Joseph's eyes before the events of the latter half of chapter 37 unfold. Right? He's been given these dreams that we talked about last week, right? That he is going to be exalted, and that his brothers and his family are going to be brought down. They're going to be bowing down to him. And he's not given just one dream, he's given two of the same meaning, confirming this promise of the Lord. Like, he will be exalted, his brothers will be brought low. Now, in the ancient, Near Eastern culture, what I'm assuming that he was expecting is that he would receive the birthright and the blessing given to him by the father. You see, when a father would have multiple sons, he would give, normally the oldest, the birthright and the blessing. And the birthright is basically, you get a double portion of my inheritance. And with that, if your brothers go into trouble, you're the one who's going to be expected to kind of help out and take care of them. And then there's the blessing where, you are there, you are going to be the leader of the family and the clan. Right? You're going to kind of be the new head of the house. And what we see in Joseph, he has these dreams of the things that God is going to accomplish, where he's exalted and his brothers are brought down, and he can see these things happening. Right? He can see that, his oldest brothers are kind of disqualifying themselves through their sin. Like the oldest, Reuben, he slept with his father's concubines, the mother of some of his brothers. And there's tension there. Simeon and Levi weren't much better. After their sister was raped, they made a deal with the father of the rapist, because he said, my son wants to marry her now. They said, you and your entire town need to get circumcised. We can't give one of ours to an uncircumcised people. So they do. And while they're wounded and bandaged up, waiting to recover, Simeon and Levi go and slaughter all the men of the town, taking the women, the children, the cattle, the plunder of this entire city. And Jacob looks at them and he says, "You have brought trouble on me by making me obnoxious to the people living in this land. We were few in number, and if they join forces against me and attack me, I and my entire household will be destroyed." So you see that the oldest are starting to disqualify themselves through their sin, through following their lusts and passions. The sons of the concubines, they're not really up for, they're not part of the discussion of who's going to receive the birthright and the blessing. And he can see that, I'm the father's favorite. He's given me this robe. It's a designation of where I stand before him. And it seems my path forward is just a straight line, a slow and steady walk to the top, while my brothers are brought low, continuing to disqualify themselves through their own sins. But I'm going to be the guy. This is how the Lord's will is going to be fulfilled in my life. This is how this dream, or these dreams, are going to come to fruition, right? He's expecting a smooth journey. He's expecting a straight line to the top. But that's not what he does, is it? That's not how the Lord's plans for him unfold. Because, his expectations don't meet the reality of the situation, because what we end up seeing is that God is in the midst of orchestrating not a straight line for him to go to the top, but he is bringing him through death into a new life. He's bringing him from, you know, bringing him down into humiliation and despair before bringing him up to the place of prominence. God is orchestrating what Ian Duguid called his painful providence over his life. Right, look at the coincidences that set this scene where Joseph's brothers, the evil in their heart, could be exposed and that he would become their victim. Right? He, you know, as he goes to check on them and they're not there, they happen across a man who saw them, who knew that, you know, who he's talking about, who heard their plans of where they were going. Perhaps even note that, you know, coming across a man may not be expected because this is Shechem. This is the land that Simeon and Levi slaughtered just a couple chapters ago and slaughtered the men of the town. They come across this man and he happens to know. And as they're plotting, what, you know, Reuben is there. And he says, well, hey, don't kill him. We'll just throw him in a pit, hoping that he can save him later. And it just happens that traders are, you know, the Midianites are passing through, that they can sell him to them. And when they come through, it just happens that Reuben is not there to prevent his being sold. It all just happens. Is this coincidences, or is this God's painful providence to set up his circumstances to accomplish his will? But it's not just these, you know, circumstances, these potential coincidences, but even the sins that fill this family all working together to make this happen. The murderous hatred of his brothers, the sins of his father and his favoritism over Jacob. Even Reuben's desire to redeem himself that ultimately preserved his life, but foiled their plans. Why does Reuben want to save him? Is it because he's just a good guy? Probably not. Reuben wants to get back into the good graces of his father after his grave violation of his half-brother's mother. It's why when he comes back and he realizes Joseph isn't there anymore, well, he doesn't say, oh, my brother, he says, the boy isn't there. Where can I turn now? He was my meal ticket back into good graces. He's my ticket to being back in the favor of my father to reclaim my spot. But he's gone now. And even Joseph's own issues and sins that exacerbated his issue and you know, sticking the knife in his brothers by telling his dream and slandering some of his other brothers for their own misdeeds. Or for having misdeeds. You know, all these things are working together in order to create this circumstance where Joseph, rather than having this straight line up, is brought through death, is thrown in a pit, is barely escapes with his life. And of course, you know, we who know the story and knows that he's going to go through many trials, but ultimately be at the Pharaoh's right hand and save the world and reconnect, you know, his entire family and reunite them unite them as a people. And we know this, but how does it start? Well, it starts with Joseph being crushed by God. In God's painful providence that wields all these circumstances, including the sins of others and Joseph's own issues, together to tell a story, to create something. And this, perhaps, is either the scary thought or the comforting thought. That this is the way that God works for his people oftentimes. That he brings them through the fire. That he carries them through deep waters. That he walks them through rivers that are too great to bear, but doesn't let them completely overtake them. That he causes them to walk through great hardships, to be thrown in a pit, to experience a death of their own kind. And yet, his presence and his grace is the one that's not only sustaining them, but it's the thing, very thing that has brought it to pass. The painful providence of God. At times, I like to imagine Joseph, if he was in a modern context, and, you know, all this stuff has happened to me, right? I thought I was on the inn with my father, my brothers. They saw me. They almost killed me. They threw me into a pit. As I was crying out to them, they just kept eating their lunch, ignoring my pleas, letting them fall on deaf ears, selling me into slavery. And what, you know, I can imagine him, you know, typing his story out on some Reddit board. And people would, you know, give him advice. And I think the advice would be pretty, like, man, that is some serious trauma. You know what you need? Well, you need to see a counselor. And I can imagine, and maybe he does. And he goes and he sits in office and he explains his story. And I can imagine, you know, a counselor just thinking in his head, like, yikes, what am I going to do for this guy? How am I going to take this guy who's been so damaged by circumstances and make them into somebody who's halfway functional, who can just get through life? And maybe after many sessions and many years, to be able to take this person who's been crushed and make them somebody who can function halfway normally. And sometimes those are important things and necessary things, but just the question is, how much more powerful, how much more healing, how much more sustaining for Joseph's life is not necessarily, you know, these deep introspective things, but knowing the story in which all these things happened. Knowing that when he was, you know, thrown in the pit and hated by his brothers and all these things happened, that this was part of a story that God was writing, that it was through this that God was going to exalt him, and that it's through this evil that his brothers did that God was going to do good, that he was going to use this to unite this family that's broken and fractured, and he was going to make something beautiful out of it. How much greater for Joseph's own mind space and you know, ability to function is understanding that in the midst of all this stuff, that this is part of God's plan, who's working not only just for God's own glory, but for Joseph's good. That through this, he would be exalted and lifted up. I think a lot. And this is what hope does for the people of God. This is what hope does for the people who've been crushed by their circumstances, who've been crushed by the sins of others against them, who have been crushed by, well, I would say, the painful providence of God in their lives. Hope assures us that's not the final word on our story. Hope assures us that despite, you know, the machinations of evildoers seeming to succeed, that there is a God whose plans continue. And what kind of God is he? Is he a distant God? Is he an aloof God? Is he a powerless God? No, the story of Joseph proclaims to us the kind of God that it is. It is a redeeming God. It is a God who takes us through the pit but raises us up. It is a God who decides once and for all that he is going to turn evil on its head, that he is going to glorify himself not through the victory, the final victory of evil, but when evil does its worst, he brings good out of it. The quote that I said a few weeks ago from novels, that children's novels, is that you know, when evil digs a pit, the maker makes a well. That's his way. That's what he does. He takes these pits that evil digs and he says, I'm going to make this thing that's a symbol of death and make it into a wellspring of life for people. This is how he operates. The world has their own version of Christian hope. It's been dubbed, you know, secular optimism. It is what happens when you buy Christian hope on wish.com. It's the cheap imitation that tries to offer to people, you know, something to hold on to. And it basically goes like, you know, the world is continuing to get better. You know, through technological advances, through humanitarian efforts, you know, the grinding poverty of yesteryear is almost vanquished. You know, wells are being dug in Africa. Medical interventions through people who would normally be blind for the rest of their lives and now can see. People aren't starving to death on nearly as regular of a basis. And this has been, you know, the framework of viewing the world in some optimistic thing, but it's coming crashing and crumbling down, largely because it does nothing for the person who's actually suffering. The whole metric and story is that on average, things are getting better, but for the person where things are getting worse, it has nothing to say, except you're more alone because less people are suffering. It judges everything by the comfort and pleasure and satisfaction of the moment. And for the sufferer of the moment, it offers no story that can give it any sort of meaning or hope or satisfaction. Nothing to keep it going. But for the Christian who knows the God of Scriptures, who knows that He is, you know, not only he is the kind of God who redeems us from the pit, who sees us in these circumstances that we find ourselves, who sees us as the object of other people's sin, but He uses that. As Paul says, that all things work together for good for those who love God and are called according to His purposes. All things. The sins against you. Your broken circumstances. Your dysfunctional family. That there is a God who, well, can turn all evil to good. The social sciences kind of bear this out, how the people of God are sustained. I shared it, if you are somebody who's kind of on the fence or you know, peripherally related to the church, here's a reason to consider the claims that we're making, because it sustains God's people. It sustains people who hold on to it. And it's not just being here. It's not just going through the motions. It's just that those whose lives are dependent upon the God receive a peace and a joy and a hope that sustains them through the worst parts of life. Social scientists will often distinguish between what's called intrinsic and extrinsic religiosity. Extrinsic is like I go through the motions of religious things hoping that I'm going to receive some sort of benefit. For older generations, it's like, well, I go to church not because I believe it or care about it, but because it's just what respectable people do. For younger people, oftentimes, it's I consider myself a Christian or perhaps an evangelical, not because it means much to me, but because I view it as a giant middle finger at the powers that be. Or for some who go to, churches that have emptied out the hard truths of the scriptures, where the Christian scriptures are merely used to reinforce the paradigm of the day. This is extrinsic religiosity, and what the social sciences show us is that this has almost no benefit to the people who practice, and sometimes it can even be harmful. But for those who have an intrinsic faith, which means, you know, a faith that's, it is the most important part of my life that dictates, well, who I am and how I react, what we see, and it's incredibly clear, less depressed, less anxious, less lonely, less likely to commit suicide, less likely to commit a crime. Another study is, you know, those who study their Bible at least four times a week. You know, loneliness drops by 30%. Anger issues drop by 32%. Bitterness in relationships drop by 40%. And why is this? It's because when you take your faith seriously, what the God of the Scriptures proclaims himself to be, what you see is that this God is a redeeming God. That when you are in a pit, it doesn't mean that you have been forsaken by God. It doesn't mean you have been left alone by God. It doesn't mean that evil has won. It means that there is a greater and grander story. One where we see the Almighty's power, not just to sustain his people away from evil, but to take the evil that we have received, that we have experienced, and say, this is something I'm going to make beautiful. This is a story that's going to turn evil on its head. And this is something, well, worth resting in. Hope, Christian hope, it receives the benefits of knowing the fullness of the story without knowing the details of the plan. It knows that when, even though I am out of control and it seems that you know, evil is done and I cannot stop, I cannot use through my own ingenuity, my own power to stop it from happening, there is a God who's still in control, who's still at work, who leads us through the fire, who walks us through deep waters, who while we pass through the rivers, we are not overcome. I began this morning with the story of Lars Doucette, the man whose son is basically brain dead. And in the midst of this, his Christian faith is apparent. That even though while his son is laying there and he suffers in some ways, well, re-experiences the trauma of his death every time he sees him. And yet, that's not the end of his story. And he writes to the world, I cling relentlessly to joy. And those who are wanting to agree and talk about the unimaginable horror that he says, and he writes towards the very end, he says, the correct adjective for the tragedy I'm experiencing is not unimaginable, but unfathomable. I can imagine it just fine because it's happening to me, and you can imagine it too because I'm describing it to you. And because we can imagine it, we can turn and face it, and with God's grace, we can lift up our cross and bear it somehow. But what none of us can do is to measure, to fathom the depth of it. What is he saying in the midst of his grief? Is that, yes, it's unfathomable. I can't measure how great and deep the pain goes, but yet, at the same time, I can find God's grace there. I can pick up my cross. I can keep going. Why? Because even as I go deeper and deeper and deeper, God is still there. God's grace is still there. He's not left. He's not abandoned. He's writing a story that includes this. And so as the people of God, we cling to this hope in the midst of hardship. In the midst of feeling at the bottom and crushed by the painful providence of God, this hope that there is a God in heaven whose story is continued to write. And even if our story ends in death or the death of our children, that the faithfulness, the providence, the redemption of this God does not cease there. It continues. And that's good news for the people of God, isn't it? I'd like to call up the worship team as we prepare to sing a final song. And I am sorry, I'm going to call a little bit of an audible. After the song, I want to give an opportunity for people to, I say, proclaim the ways that God has sustained them, to give a testimony to the ways that they have already experienced God's mighty power in the midst of hardship and despair. And so as the worship team sings this next song, I want you to listen to the Spirit. And he's saying, I want you to proclaim my goodness. I want to call you to do that afterwards. And so I'll have a mic, and Pastor Wes, you can help me with another mic. And, you'll be able to let us know. And what we want to do is be able to say, yeah, this is true about God. This is how he sustained me. This is how he brought me out of the pit. This is how, when he's walked me through the fire, I was not burned. When he walked with me through deep waters, I was not consumed. This is the God of the Scriptures. He's exactly as he proclaimed himself to be. Let's pray. Kind Father, we give you all thanks and praise for your grace, that even while we don't see it, and sometimes we are blind to the grace in your providence. We trust in it. We know that you are indeed a God who brings us up from the pit. We know you are a God who secures your people. That sin of our own, sin of others, bad circumstances, that none of these stop or hinder your plan. We believe and we know that you are indeed a good and gracious God, and that in these things, that you are with us, that you secure us. So come, Lord, and speak to us by your Spirit again. In the name of Jesus, amen. Stay with us as we close.